Thank you very much for a nice introduction. First of all, I would like to congratulate this conference celebrating the 150th anniversary of Jose Rizal. It's a great pleasure for me to attend this conference and have an opportunity to present a paper as a participant from Japan. It took a rather long time for me to decide to come to this conference simply because I am not the Rizal specialist. However, when I came here last February and found that the conference will be held at the Toyota Auditorium, I understood that I made the right decision, because if no Japanese give a paper here, Japan might be blamed again that Japan can still donate the building but not provide any knowledge. Let's go to the next slide, please. Much has already been discussed on Jose Rizal's relations with Japan, like his trip to Japan, through which he met a Japanese woman, Osei-san, or Rizal's influence on a Japanese famous writer, Seihiro Techo, in the late 1880s. These works place Jose Rizal in the context of the Philippine-Japan relations when Japan started to take an infant step for its imperial state, while in the Philippines, reforms under Spanish colonial rule had been the crucial agenda that led the path to the Philippine Revolution. Next slide, please. Considering the significance of these studies on one hand, this paper attempts a different approach on Rizal's relationship to Japan. This paper tried to place Jose Rizal in the Philippines in comparison of the emperor in Japan as a national symbol. These two countries in Asia has been influenced so much by the United States, the former from the early 20th century under American rule, and the latter from the end of Asian Pacific War. Next slide, please. In this perspective, assumption would possibly be made that the benevolent assimilation policy toward the Philippines under American rule could be understood as a forerunner of U.S. occupation policy towards Japan during the post-war period. By doing so, we might aim to project an alternative approach on the Philippine relations to Japan by looking things beyond the conventional eyes on Philippine-Japan relations that has located the former as colonial state and latter as colonial master. Next slide, please. And this is a part of our project, Philippines and Japan in American Shadow, and recently come out from National University of Singapore Press. And next slide, please. And this is the English version. And next slide, please. And this is the Japanese version. And Japanese version was just come out 2 weeks ago, so I'm so really relaxed. Next slide, please. And before going to the text, I want to show some small episode, relationship of the Jose Rizal and the General Douglas MacArthur. The Rizal first arrived in 1888, February, and arrived at Yokohama, as you might know, and stayed at Grand Hotel. Next slide, please. And then proceeded to Tokyo and met Osei-san and went to San Francisco in April. Next slide, please. And this is a photo of the famous Grand Hotel in Yokohama. And next slide, please. And this is a wonderful hotel. And then next slide, please. And this, so the Rizal was served by in that way. And this, next slide, please. And this hotel was demolished in 1923 because of the Kanto earthquake. Now we have a strong earthquake last March, so we can imagine how the damage. And this Grand Hotel was re-established after the Kanto earthquake. Now we have the Hotel New Grand in Yokohama in the same place. Next slide, please. And this one. We can easily go. And then you, next slide, please. Then you may find in the same New Grand Hotel, you will see MacArthur suit on the third floor, and actually MacArthur stayed. Next slide, please. MacArthur This is his third time to come to Japan. The first time he came to Japan from the Philippines with a father. Second visit was a second, honeymoon. This is his third visit. Then he stayed this hotel, and then even now we can go to that room. Here is a photo of Makasa, and he stayed 3 nights after he landed in Atsugi Air Base, 15 miles from Yokohama, August 13, 1945, and proceeds to Tokyo and occupied Japan after the war. So next slide, please. So this is a connection between Hosiri-san and Douglas MacArthur. But today I want to talk about the similarity and difference of the Hosiri-san and Japanese emperor in American Shadow. One of the obvious reasons why Japan and the Philippines has not been considered as comparative nation is that while for Filipinos, U.S. colonial rule in the first half of the 20th century has been a staple of the official collective memories, the U.S. occupation of Japan technically lasted only for 7 years, except for Okinawa. Although only a relatively short period, U.S. occupation decisively reshaped Japan in the post-war era. This is a fact widely acknowledged today, but has been gradually forgotten in Japan by the early 1970s. Japan's phenomenal economic recovery and success lasted until the end of the Cold War very much relied upon the political and economic structure primarily established under the U.S. occupation policy implemented by General Douglas MacArthur in the late 1940s. At the same time, it is important to note that, as John Dower excellently discusses in Embracing Defeat, the name of U.S. occupation policy in Japan could be understood as a scapegoat model or a hybrid Japanese-American model. The scapegoat model means the collaboration between the supreme command for the Allied powers, SCAP, namely USGHQ, General Headquarters, and Japanese political elite. Next slide, please. And John Dower mentions how the SCAPANI model should be. Next slide, please. Dower's book title itself, Embracing Defeat, carries a connotation of mercy and to see such a miserable situation from every corner of defeated Japan. This suggests that Dower, although he is an excellent American scholar of Japanese history, has not completely freed himself from the blind spots that inhere in regarding post-war Japanese history from outside of Japan. In spite of my strong feeling of ambiguity about the book's title, however, what I have found useful for Dower's otherwise exhaustive and compelling account is that post-war Japan was not the mere creature of GHQ, but the product of the collaboration between GHQ and Japanese political elite. I retain my opinion that Dower's frame of analysis is substantially correct, and part 4 of the book on democracies gives us a chance to rethink the nature of Japanese democratic development. Dower sees post-war democracy in Japan to consist in 3 natures or features: imperial democracy, constitutional democracy, and censor democracy. Of these 3, imperial democracy is what Dower seems to consider most important for understanding the nature of post-war Japan society or hybrid nature of Japan-American model thereby formed. In the post-war constitution, the emperor was newly placed as a national symbol instead of the sovereign in the pre-war constitution. This crucial place, the emperor at the center of Japanese citizens' efforts to rebuild the country. Paradoxically, however, to make over the emperor into national symbol, the post-war constitution does not state clearly who should occupy the position of the sovereign in Japan. We might read this particular ambiguity of the post-war Japanese constitution as a reflection of ambiguous motives underpinning the Japanese model itself. It swings as it does between the measure of keeping the old political and administrative system intact and seems for creating a new system of Japanese democracy, no matter how hybrid. It also mirrors the ambiguous attitude of post-war Japanese government when relating to the question of responsibility for the Asian-Pacific War and to the Asian countries affected by the destructive consequences to the present. Please go back to the slide number 17, table of contents. Go back to slide, please. Table contents. Yes, go back. Yes. Let's go back to go to the benevolent assimilation in the Philippines. What is lacking from the work of Dower and other Japanese studies scholars is that perspective that Japanese model or hybrid Japanese American model is a kind of replica of the United States pacification policy in the Philippines and establishment of its colonial rule there under the mantle of benevolent assimilation during the first half of the 20th century. One can say that Japanese model or hybrid Japanese model is not the mere creature or a product of the United States Cold War policy and politics. It is rather the product of the American colonial policy that has already embedded itself and germinated in the American-Philippine experiment itself a century earlier. Considering the later Japanese variant in terms of its earlier precedent, allow us to conceptualize the distinctive feature of U.S. empire building historically and in critically comparative fashion missing from the existing studies. It is widely known that American colonial policy for the Philippines was first and best expressed by the President Mackinder's Benevolent Assimilation Proclamation issued on December 1898. To pursue the principle of the colonial rule as declared by Mackinder, one important agenda that the United States needed to tackle was the establishment of the autonomous and political and legislative system in the Philippines. The United States pragmatically chose to promote or enhance the institution of autonomous government by Filipinos under U.S. tutelage. Such a policy, often acclaimed as exceptional in honor of colonial rule, meant introduction of the American-type political and legislative system in the Philippines, but only largely run by Filipinos themselves. To remake the Philippine political and legislative system in the American image, it was imperative for U.S. government officials, as it was to prove equally so in the case of post-war Japan and Japanese leadership, to forge close ties with an emergent Philippine political elite from whose ranks could be drawn the manpower of autonomous and surrogate government under American guidelines. At this point, it is noteworthy that when the first general election of the Philippine Assembly was held in 1907, it was a nationalist party headed by Selfie Osmania and Manuel Quezon won the majority of the seat. Since then, with several stages of conflicts and despite the division into various factions that was characterized colonial Filipino party politics, Nationalist Party went on and continued to dominate the Philippine political process throughout the American colonial period. By discussing the historical experience of the two U.S. occupation regimes in the Philippines and Japan, we have shown what was previously ignored and neglected as historical facts. That is, the salient similarities between these two countries, which has been otherwise considered as completely different nations in their historical, cultural, or social features and aspect. One of the most striking discoveries here is that hybrid Philippine experience and experiment of U.S. can actually be understood and must be further explored as a forerunner of its history of decisive intervention in modern Japan. Now let's go to the mystification of Jose Rizal. Floro Kibuen's provocative book, A Nation Aborted, Rizal, American Hegemony and Philippine Nationalism, offer a detailed examination of Rizal's role as a national symbol for American colonial rule in the Philippines. It is a critical effort in rethinking the instrumentality of the United States in transforming the regime and role of Jose Rizal in the Philippine Revolution at the initial stage of U.S. colonial conquest. The book's 10th chapter, Remaking Philippine History, amply hint as a process initiated by the U.S. colonial administration to appropriate the image of José Rizal as a major ideological sanction for the colonial policy in the Philippines with a willing collaboration of Philippine counterpart. Kibuen cites three major readings of Rizal during the American colonial period by quoting Reynald Ireto's orator and crowd. Ireto has argued that one of these readings consisted in, quote, nationwide hero worship of Rizal to transfer Philippine adoration away from revolutionary heroes towards an advocate of pacifist and constitutional nationalism, unquote. The second reading of Rizal pointed out by Ireto concerned, quote, that of the conservative Ilustrado's view of Rizal as a symbol both of the opposition to flyer supremacy and of revolutionary change, unquote. Kibuen contends that this version complemented the American view. The third reading totally competed with the American view, and Ireto called it the subversive reading of Rizal. As Kibuen summarized Ireto's arguments, this is, quote, a popular image of Rizal that was shared by Malo's Republic under the Aguinaldo and by peasant groups such as Kororum, and that persisted through the American colonial regime, unquote. Backed by the above-mentioned narratives, Kibuen contends that, quote, it was a stroke of genius, therefore, on the part of American regime to have seized the symbol of Rizal to further their own colonial agenda. However, during the early years of new regimes, American population Rizal was resisted, unquote. But how exactly did American administration maneuver to remake or mystify the symbol of José Rizal to ensure the success of its colonial project? This should be for Filipinos' welfare, but not for independence. In order to pursue this purpose, Americans had to write Philippine history and reinvent Rizal with their Orientalist views. Kibuen details this process by dividing it into two stages as set by the two Philippine commissions, namely Schumann's and Taft. Here it is clear that what the United States essentially attempted was to cut off the intimate tie of José Rizal as Mayto of the Philippine nation that was in emergence with popular sentiment by projecting the image of José Rizal as a mere reformist. This attempt by American colonizers seemed to have succeeded, indeed, through various means like the workings of public education and systematic institutional education during the American colonial period and afterward. However, since 1980s, more balanced and critical portrayal of José Rizal, including a transient critique of his American mystification, has been disclosed in a whole host of revisionist efforts by Filipino scholars. Now going to the symbolization of Japanese emperor. Question of emperor has always been partaken of a so-called taboo nature in Japanese history, and it is particularly so in the case of previous Showa Tenno or Emperor Hirohito, who traversed such a long dramatic life before and after World War II. For depicting the historical process of making Emperor Hirohito as a national symbol in relation to post-war Japanese politics, Yutaka Yoshida's Showa Tenno and his end of war history is certainly the most successful work. It's scrutinizing the original documents not only in Japan, but also in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., particularly in the files of International Prosecution Section. The most striking achievement of Yoshida's book is a compelling attempt to locate the documents newly disclosed to the public in 1990, that is, memoirs of the monologue of Showa Tenno, within the framework of Japanese post-war politics. By doing so, Yoshida was able to read clearly from the memoirs the political intention of both American officers and some Japanese elite leaders in their contention for hegemony on the terrain of post-war Japanese political processes. Yoshida has determined that GHQ's treatment of Emperor system was already clear by the late August 1945. While introducing the indirect rule system, the GHQ held the view that emperor system ought to be maintained. This did not necessarily mean, of course, that the United States had already decided how to keep the emperor system and how to treat Showa Tenno himself. In this, American administrator even considered the possibility of abdication and prosecution of Showa Tenno, but not for antagonism from the Japanese populace that has resulted from such an act and likely proved to be detrimental to the purpose of American rule in Japan. Please go to the slide number 20 on Makasa in Japanese, emperor. Under this fluid situation involving the American treatment Showa Tenno, some fraction of these conservative elites started to maneuver in various ways for seizing the hegemonic position in post-war politics. The first step that approached the USGHQ was so-called Emperor Court. This group was composed by the emperor's close aides and their followers who made active representation to protect Showa Tenno from the prospect of the abdication. Their major achievement was a meeting between General Douglas Makasa and Showa Tenno in September 27, 1945. During the meeting, Makasa did not question the emperor's responsibility for the war, treating him as sovereign. That was how the GHQ itself firmly established its policy for governing post-war Japan by utilizing the authority and power of emperor. This decision led to the declaration of human emperor by Showa Tenno on January 1, 1946. Please go to the next slide. Yes. Second move among the conservative Japanese elite came from some member of the first group headed by the member of the royal family directly related to the Showa Tenno. Separating from the other member of the emperor court, they supported the idea that Showa Tenno should abdicate after taking responsibility for Japan's role in World War II. Next slide, please. This kind of opinion was even disclosed during the meeting of Privy Council of the Emperor in February 1946. Naturally, GHQ was very sensitive to this move among some royal family members because by that time, GHQ had firmly established the policy to utilize the emperor's system for stabilization of its occupation policy. Thus, the GHQ quickly responded to this move. On March 6, 1946, Brigadier General Bonaferas, Makasa's military secretary, candidly told Mitsumasa Yoneuchi, an important member of Privy Council of the Emperor, that is, Hideki Tojo, former prime minister, was to take full responsibility for the war against the United States, and that then Showa Tenno was to be completely freed from any imputation of war crime. Next slide, please. On the other hand, Takashi Fujitani discussed to the newly discovered documents of U.S. War Department in 2000. This is a memorandum on policy toward Japan written by Edwin Reischauer in September of 1942. In this memorandum, Reischauer proposed to use the emperor as the best possible puppet. Please go to the next slide. Or a tool for the post-war rule. What Reischauer meant as a puppet emperor is nothing but the emperor as a national symbol enacted under GHQ after the war. Here, Fujitani emphasized that Reischauer conceived the puppet emperor based on American racism against Asians and paid his keen attention to the fact that Reischauer discussed the issue of emperor by linking with the problem how to deal with Japanese Americans in U.S. combat units. Reischauer proposed that inclusion of Japanese American into U.S. military would be, quote, best possible proof that is not a racial war to preserve white supremacy ensia, but a war to establish a better world order for all, regardless of race, unquote. Please go to next slide. For Fujitani, this statement meant that Raishō proposed to use both imperial system and Japanese Americans as a tool for U.S. post-war strategy based on national consciousness generally shared by white elite. In conclusion, the symbolization of Japanese emperor in post-war period was materialized through the interwoven relationship between the American administrator and conservative Japanese elite fractions. The ambiguous status of emperor in the post-war Japanese constitution brought out the dual ambiguity of Japanese responsibility for World War II, particularly the Asian-Pacific War against the United States, and also the war against East Asia and Southeast Asian countries. In the multiple historical context we have laid out so far, we might regard the symbolization of the Japanese emperors as something constituted under U.S. occupation policy to serve a certain administrative purpose in much the same way as the mystification of Jose Rizal was accomplished by the U.S. colonial state for Philippines' own earlier pacification and post-war conjuncture. Both of them, the symbolic emperor and mystic Rizal, come to occupy politically pivotal positions in popular mind and memory of the two countries respectively. But it seems equally true that there are some differences in their external implications. While the American image of Jose Rizal, a national hero, functions to maintain the Philippines as an American colony, the symbolization of Japanese emperor remained as a principle of ambiguity in Japanese attitude toward the question of their responsibility for World War II. It would be also important to point out while Japanese has accepted symbolic emperor after World War II, as it were, Rizal might have served as national martyrdom among Filipinos during the Philippine Revolution and the Philippine-American War beyond its American image that should have functions as the basis for Philippine resistance against American colonial rule. For us Japanese, World War II holds two primary meanings. The first concern, the imperial war against the United States, while the second concern, the colonially aggressive or invasive war against Asia. The symbolization of Japanese emperor under the GHQ reflects the American policy of saving Showa Tenno from his responsibility for the war, better to be able to use the institution which he stood for as a bedrock for stabilization of Japanese society under U.S. admiration after the war. Paradoxically, however, this policy had the unfortunate effects of depriving the Japanese government or citizens of the chance to confront Asian reality of the Asian-Pacific War and their responsibility for them. This post-war situation in the country certainly differs from that of Germany, whose Nazism was immediately aborted, thus clearly showing the international claims that the Holocaust represented. Why do we Japanese still face some formidable barriers in our relations with the citizens of our neighboring countries in Asia? Why do other Asian countries still regard us Japanese with suspicious eyes? We might find the roots of this problem beyond the mere focus on the U.S. occupation policy of 1945 and 1952. After this comparative discussion of strategic recasting of national symbols in the Philippines and Japan under U.S. shadow, we have reached an inescapable conclusion that to grasp the effective and political nature of national symbol in particular societies, it is imperative that we look into the relationship, interrelationship between such national symbols they represent, and how these national symbols are indigenously worshipped or regarded by the populace. Only in undertaking this kind of historical research on national symbols are we able to begin to disclose critically their genuine nature in particular society like the Philippines or Japan beyond U.S. shadow. Thank you very much.